Așa cam eu. Ok. Roshni? Your first time here? What's your name?
Harsh.
Harsh. The beautiful thing about silence is that there is no projection. Because more often than not, we are talking to people to project an image which they will approve of. with silence that's finished. So sitting in silence is quite beautiful, because then we are not trying to impress others to win their approval. We are being, and the nature of being is silence and stillness. Silence on the outside and stillness within. And Maharaj in I Am That has said, satsang, as in noble company, satsang is the supreme remedy for all ills, mental as well as physical. Because that space of being is shared, not of wanting to be something. Even Shirdi Sai Baba in Sai Satcharita has said that seek out the company of saints and sages, because you will receive tremendous benefit from them. That is satsang. And when one abides in that sense of being, that is meditation in daily living. There is a wonderful story of a young boy who asked his parents, "What is meditation?" They tried very hard to explain, but it was not easy to explain to a young boy what meditation is. So they went to Ramana Maharshi and they told him that, you know, this is a young boy and he has asked this question which we cannot answer to his satisfaction. So Ramana just smiled and said, he asked the boy to come and sit, and then he asked one of his devotees to get a dosa for the boy to eat. So the dosa came and Ramana told the boy that when I utter hmm, you start eating the dosa, and when I utter hmm again, you have to stop eating it. So the boy was very excited. So then Ramana said, hmm, and the boy attacked the dosa, really started gobbling it up. But all the time he was looking at Ramana and eating, waiting, you know, wondering whether he'll be able to finish the dosa in time or not. Now the last morsel was left. So the boy didn't take it. He's looking at Ramana, waiting for Ramana to say hmm, and Ramana said hmm, and quickly he gobbled it up. So then Ramana asked the boy that during this time, was your attention on the dosa or was it on me? So the boy replied, it was on both. So then Ramana told the boy, similarly, in life, when you are focused on your duties, but yet at the same time your mind is on God, that is meditation. And what is mind is on God? not an object, but on being, consciousness, here and now. As the famous saying goes, you are not what happens, you are the space in which things happen. That is living meditation, not restricted to half an hour or 1 hour in the morning. Abiding in your being. And how does that happen? Inversely, if you look at it, if your thinking mind is absent, you are abiding in your being. If your thinking mind, which is creating imaginary situations and stories and projections and accumulations and doubt and regrets and ill will, spite, hatred, jealousy, envy, is not functioning, automatically you are abiding in your being. And to understand why is the thinking mind functioning the way it is, what is its hook which makes it operate all the time, that becomes the journey. To see it in transparency and clarity, to see the sense of doership I impose on others as well as myself, when that is viewed, you will be amazed to see how much of unnecessary thinking drops away, which was garbage cluttering the mind. And if there is a deep acceptance that nobody is the doer of their actions, including me, the automatic result is the deep conviction that everything is God's will. And if there is a conviction in daily living that everything is God's will, there is an acceptance of what is. When the thinking mind is engaged, there's too much dependence on rationality. We are trying to rationalize everything that happens in our lives, questioning it. The intuitive seeing gets blocked. the what is gets blocked. When we die, after we die, there is death, right? We are afraid of death. Now, before were we born, when we were born, weren't we dead? We were dead, so to speak, before we were born. And at the end, we'll be dead. Why are we not afraid of the death before we were born? Why are we not afraid of our absence before we were born, but we are so concerned with what will happen with death? Is that rational? It's the same thing. That is how rational we are. It sounds completely irrational. That is the way it has been designed. We have been designed to fear death. And what the teaching does is it lets us see all this. What comes into being at birth? What ends at death? What is present in deep sleep? Could that which is prior to birth and after death and in deep sleep be absent in the waking state? And all our preoccupations are to do with surviving. Me. What will happen to me? Me and my story. My preservation. My protection. So it is a very limited aspect of consciousness which is so concerned with its survival. Why do we see sages so much at peace? Because they are abiding in their beingness. The thinking mind of the me with all this accumulation does not function in them. So they will embrace death simply because, like everything in life is unknown, you never know what the next moment brings, nor does death. So their life is already being lived like that. Whereas we are running around in circles full of fear. The sage has accepted that one never knows what the next moment in life is going to bring, pleasure or pain. We have not accepted that. We are fearful. But the basic duality of life, which is sometimes pleasure, sometimes pain, is something we don't accept. But can you accept only black and not white? Will the world function like that? Only up and no down. Only left and no right. This is duality. And the spiritual seeking begins when one thinks about, why is it that I am only seeking pleasure? Why am I avoiding pain? What is life trying to show me through my pain? That is why it is said that it is normally suffering which brings us onto the path, because then these questions arise. If things start giving me happiness and my experience is that it just keeps collapsing all the time, then obviously true happiness cannot be found like that. That is the start of the journey. But to keep wishing, in spite of one's life experience, that I must do things to protect myself, to safeguard myself from the pains of life, you are adding misery onto your existing misery, because that will not happen. It is not designed like that. You can go to temples and pray that only good things should happen to me, bad things. How do you know what is good and what is bad? There is a phrase which Vimalananda had said, I don't remember the Sanskrit words, but it says, deep is the flow of the river of karma. It's impossible to comprehend. So how do you know what is good or what is bad? So when that incessant control which we try to impose on life starts reducing, then we become comfortable with others, ourselves, and what is. We become comfortable with our pain. And what happens is, one is more and more established in witnessing. And when one is more and more established in witnessing, one is more and more comfortable with the idea of death. Because death is the death of the me. There is no fear of death in deep sleep. And then the perspective shifts on life. Because unlike animals, the human beings have been given a tremendous gift. Which is their sense of being. An animal cannot separate being from experience. The human being can. Human being. The race of humans is called Homo sapiens sapiens. Those who are aware that they are aware. See, it's so obvious, we overlook all this. And what is satsang? That beingness is shared. We come back to the same point. But we are so conditioned that if we had to choose between meeting our 15 friends for an outing or being in a gathering where 15 people are sitting in silence, we'd most likely choose the former. I had read David Godman's, I think it was a part of an interview where someone asked him about his time with Maharaj. And he said a lot of the foreigners requested Maharaj if they can sit in his attic and meditate in addition to the satsangs. So initially he allowed it. But he would go about doing his chores. He would read his newspaper, he'd do the dusting, clean the photographs. But all the time he was looking at the people who were meditating. And one day he got quite upset, as he was known to be. And he said, you know, y'all are just pretending. Most of you are pretending that y'all are meditating, but I know exactly who is doing what in this room. And out of all of y'all, only one person is in contact with his beingness. The others' minds are either all over the place, or they're opening their eyes to see what I'm doing quietly and then shutting them when I look at them. And he said, so I would suggest something more useful to y'all. Instead of wasting mana here, go and sit on the toilet, because at least there you'll be doing something useful. So that is why one's daily living is where the meditation must happen. That is the ground. One has been allotted this lifespan. Not meditation as a practice. By all means, sit for an hour or two, because, or half an hour, whatever you like, because that even permeates into the other hours, because you get a touch of that. But any practice cannot operate in isolation unless your entire daily living is viewed from that prism. And then it becomes an all-embracing, beautiful journey of life when nothing is rejected, including suffering and pain. Including wanting to run away from pain, even that is not rejected. And then we stop building walls between us and life and what is, and between us and others as separate, something they did to us or something we did to them. The obsession with building walls starts reducing. What brings you here, Harsh?
Actually, my sister came here before, so she was like, you come with me, let's go and like, okay, I'm excited to go here.
Your sister?
Yeah.
You know, my sister dragged me to meet my teacher, and I didn't forgive her for that initially. Because it was a Sunday morning and it was so precious to me. And I said, what are you doing wasting my Sunday morning? And at the end of that first talk, I was even more convinced that she wasted my morning. And so at the end, when I saw everyone bow down to touch the Guru's feet, I felt that I must do the same, because it seems to be the done thing. So I did that, thinking in my mind that I will never come back here. And then we went, and I really told my sister off, you know. But next Sunday, she flew back to Hong Kong. She used to live in Hong Kong at the time. The next Sunday, I questioned myself that, you know, I mean, other people were there. They seemed to be there from all over the world. And this man was simply saying things like, everything is God's will. You know, nothing unusual. He was sitting in his kurta pajama. Let me go back again, because it sounds too odd to me. And what was even more odd was at the end of the satsang, there was 10 minutes of bhajans in Marathi. And I would see all the foreigners reciting the bhajans in Marathi, and I was bewildered, you know, I was shocked. So I said, I must go back and see this. So I went back, and again I felt he's saying nothing really out of the ordinary, but people are coming all from all over the world. Again, I saw them line up to touch his feet, and again I went, stood in the line, and I touched his feet. Now, this time I found someone tapping my head. So I looked up, and it was him. So, you know, I said, so he said, weren't you here last Sunday? So I said, yes. So he said, be careful, young man, because this might just become your Sunday church. And I went to him for 9.5 years. Just shows that one never knows the journey life takes. So in case someone forces you to go anywhere, don't curse them yet. Wait for a couple of years. There's a friend of mine who passed away very recently. He was ailing. He wasn't a close friend, but someone I saw often. And truly, all I would do is when I crossed his path, we would visit the same health club. He would come sometimes, and there was a reception area. One day I was walking out, and he asked me, he said, I feel so nice when I see you walking past or looking at me. I see so peace, feel so peaceful. So would you mind that if we just sat for a couple of minutes in the reception, and then you go? And I was so touched, you know. And then I remembered Maharaj's one sentence, where he said, only as a witness can you truly help another. And believe me, that is all that happened. There were no words exchanged. I knew he was getting enough advice on his illness from many well-wishers. I didn't need to add to that. I would sit on the chair. He would sit next to me. Sometimes I would look at him and he would look back. Sometimes he would not look at each other. I would be just truly sitting for a minute or so, 2 minutes, that's it. And then we'd part ways. And once, about, I would say, 6 to 8 months ago, he is no more now, 6 to 8 months ago, he had asked me, he said, my cycles of chemotherapy are going on in Pune, and would you please come? And I was very touched, but I thought there must be so many family, friends, well-wishers. So I hesitated going, you know. But I felt if someone from who is going through pain has asked, one must go. So I planned a trip to Pune such that I would visit him. Me and my wife went. And I was so surprised that there was nobody in his room except him and his wife. And we sat there for 15 minutes with him, spoke a bit. And all he said was, "It's so nice that you just came." And all I said at the end was, "It was so nice for you to call us." And that was it. It gives people tremendous strength if one is just there for them. Nothing more is required of trying to project one's point of view, one's suggestions, one's data. Just being present is really a gift one can give people. And when you accept people for who they are, you are being present to them. There are no cartwheels going on in the mind about judgments. How could there be? Because if everyone is a creation of God, including yourself, if everyone has some good points and bad points, that will not happen. That is being present. Being present is the absence of the thinking mind. There's no technique to be done to be present. Someone had written to me about, I think, a meditation technique now quite popular called the heartfulness technique, or I don't know if anyone has heard of it. So I was going through a book on it, and the lineage or the gurus or teachers who teach this, even there he speaks about, I think the last part is about how do you know a guru is the right one for you or teacher is the right one. There too, he says, by the sense of peace and calm. Nothing more is required. Roshni, you were unwell?
According to me, I'm not. I don't think so.
No. What's your name? I've forgotten.
Aditi.
So where do you all stay?
Back.
Come a long way. Where do you stay? Not further than them, right?
No, I'm placed in Kalyan.
Kalyan.
Yeah.
Vanuja, you're in Nepensi Road or?
Kemp's Corner.
Kemp's Corner. Ah. And what about you?
Anyone.
Oh, so you all know each other. And so she dragged you here.
She dragged me, I just asked her. I said, you.
What's your name?
I'm Falguni.
Falguni. You all go to Anubhavananda, you also go?
Yeah.
How often does he come to Bombay?
Throughout the year, he's here for six months.
Oh, in Bombay?
In Bombay.
Oh, I didn't know. That means 6 months at Prempuri?
Yes.
Oh.
Not consecutive, yes. Uh-huh. Often
only comes. How old is he now? What a jolly man.
Yes.
No?
Yes.
I think a sense of humor is great to have, you know. That's what enables one to see through a lot in life. Anup, what are you doing now?
I'm working with this media
company. Ah, you've been with them for a while, right?
Yeah.
Happy?
Sort of.
Sort of is still good enough. I think I had seen one Calvin and Hobbes cartoon strip where Calvin tells Hobbes life is hard, so Hobbes replies, but compared to what? My favorite cartoon strip, which I keep saying every now and then, is about Calvin coming back from school with this big bag full of books, you know. And his mother said, so how was school today? And he said, Mom, I'm so happy that it's over that I'm almost glad I went. Maybe we'll say that at the end of our lives. I tell you, comics can really be so revealing. Do you do anything, Falguni, in life or?
Yeah, I do teach also. I teach at home and I'm also into a lot of random community service.
Community service. And what do you teach?
I teach English.
English. Any questions anyone wants to ask? Or to share anything? Finally, the teaching has appeared.
Teaching was poured from all over the places. It's like, I'm just happy.
Teaching has really helped me to find this settled down space, at least in professional space, because you deal with such wide variety of individuals, clients or your superiors. So it just made it very easy to accept everyone's ego.
Very true. That is why my teacher, who was a bank manager, when I met him on Sundays, he would be very keen to know the impact of the teaching at work. You know, because you deal with clients, suppliers, staff members, such a variety of people, situations. So that led to an essay I had written called Journeys at the Office Desk. All what I experienced at work through the prism of this understanding. That's either in, I think, The End of Separation or Explosion of Love, in one of those two books that essay is there. So if you haven't read it, then I would suggest looking at that, because it is the ground on which one can truly see relationships playing out. And then you see that the work was also meant to be. See, a lot of us look at work just as work, but all relationships in life are for what? Rinanubandhan. They are there to teach us something. Work is one thing. The people you are working with, your approach to them, what you learn from them, that is actually the real reason why you have come together. That is, of course, with all spheres of life. And even more so with people you don't get along with. But work is truly a very great space to see this dynamic emerging. And when you start out young, with this understanding, it's a tremendous gift. Because it's no longer individuals who are looked at.
Do they take a rickshaw? Do they take a car? You know, like, so I don't want her to I want to introduce the concept more, but I don't want her to fear it. At the same time, I want to give her, like, how, you know, that example you just said about the dosa, and you know how he gave that example to the child to understand it. How do I explain it to her?
The way you think you should.
I'm drawing a blank. I can say after some time. I'll tell you tomorrow.
You know, it reminds me of the Buddha. And his father, when he was told that, you know, you better watch it because your son could either be a great emperor or a great, great mystic. And he did all he thought he could, to prevent his son from being a mystic. And that is precisely what went against him, because when the son realized that he's living a life in paradise and took that ride outside the palace and saw death in the face, it is precisely what the father was trying to avoid which happened, and which led to the Buddha becoming the Buddha. So, first of all, children do not have the fear of death. It is we who condition them with our fear of death. The child emerges from beingness for the first 3 years of life, 3 to 4 years. The ego sets in at about 1.5 to 2 years. But the first 3 years of life is pure being. Everything is magical to the child. It has no concept that it is going to die. You see? And then what comes in with separation is the conditioning which is put into the child. And then the child starts questioning, because such an alien concept, the child knows deep down, I am not going to die. That is the Bal Krishna. The child does not need to be convinced that it is going to die, because it knows it can't die. What can't die? You see? So then this inquiry which the child, like even my niece, starts asking. So many people I know whose children at the age of about 6, 7, you know, start asking these questions. It is life which is happening to them through this inquiry. This is the way the ego is starting to churn. Right? Now, when I say that you must tell the child whatever you think and feel you should, because the parents, the child is growing up under the umbrella of the parents, right? In fact, in the Indian scriptures, they say the child's first gurus are the parents. You know? So what you feel, you know your child best. You don't need to ask 10 people what I need to tell my child. You know your child's nature, you know your child's thinking. You just have to, in awareness, say what you feel is appropriate, because why would that be wrong? You know what I'm trying to say? Because the child has his own destiny or her own destiny, which will unravel. But to postpone the inquiry, the child will start wondering, why am I not getting my answers? So there should not be a fear of, am I answering right or wrong? You see? Because you're postponing, there can be a sense of frustration in the child.
There is no right or wrong answer.
There is never a right or wrong. Because if you accept yourself the way God has made you, if you truly accept that, your view will be equally valid. There may be a concern that am I saying the right thing or wrong thing. But to postpone it is to postpone a situation unnecessarily. That is my understanding. Everyone's journey is the journey of me. You are born into the me. Me and my story. That is why we take birth. And her journey will unravel like everyone else's, which is the ultimate journey is the death of the me, not the physical death, the death of the me and my story. That is when your reactions start reducing as you grow up with understanding. Reactions shift because you're not layering sanskara upon sanskara and sanskara, not getting triggered by the same things again and again and again. Like he said in his business meeting, the other people slept. But when there's that understanding that this is what was meant to be, you're no longer keeping on poking that sanskara and revitalizing it and causing reactions in others and in yourself. A lot of us do that unconsciously. So it is conscious parenting. It doesn't mean there's a right or wrong. Just conscious parenting. And one has to see how beautiful it is that such questions are being asked by the child. That is actually pure intelligence operating, discovering. That must be honored. No, don't ask me this, don't bother me now. You know, the child must not be made to feel that it's not right to ask about these things. I think it's very beautiful. Lot of us as adults question all this much later. It's so beautiful that it arises naturally.